even name them. But the paper this afternoon is entitled "Folk sort of Physics Intervention and the Concept of Cause."
Right, so I'm covering one and a half of the three topics that are the theme of the conference. Intervention, definitely, physics, a half, and nothing about time. So when we intervene in the world, we're often guided by kind of folk physical theories. And I'll illustrate this with an example of something that happened to me recently. My toilet kept the water kept flowing. It wouldn't stop flowing. It kept going. And I tried the one method that through trial and error had succeeded in the past, namely wiggling the handle. But that didn't work. So with no knowledge whatsoever of plumbing, I opened up the tank, and this is what I saw. Now, just by inspecting this without needing to intervene, without needing to engage in trial and error learning, I was able to figure out a great deal just by inspection. So the handle works as a lever. When you push down on the handle, the little bar goes up. This black ball, if lowered, would cover the hole at the bottom of the tank and prevent the water from flowing out. This chain was tangled around the rod. If that chain were untangled, the ball would hang lower, and so on. And this guided me to the appropriate intervention, namely to untangle the chain. And I could figure that out just by looking at it and kind of my understanding of some basic principles of how the world works, of naive physics. This all seems very natural and as if it would almost go without saying, and how could it possibly be otherwise? But there are a surprising series of experiments done on chimpanzees by Daniel Povinelli and his collaborators and some other people that I'll talk about suggest that chimpanzees and other primates aren't able to engage in this kind of reasoning. That is, they're not able to have their interventions in the world guided by an effective folk physical theory. So I'll give you an example of some of the experiments that were done. So we've got here a shelf. And on the shelf, we have an apple. And it's sitting there on the shelf. And the apple is out of reach. So in order to get the apple, we have to somehow knock the apple off the shelf and get it. And this task is made a little bit more tricky because we have a plastic screen in front of this. And we have to somehow dislodge the apple through the screen. So chimpanzees were presented with this task, and they were given a tool that they could use to try to do this. And this is a very sophisticated tool known as a stick. And the chimpanzees, through a process of trial and error, learned that they could pick up the stick and then use the stick and dislodge the apple, and then the apple would fall down, and then they could retrieve the apple and they could eat it. So then, that's kind of the setup for the experiment. So then the experiment was the chimpanzees were presented with a novel tool. And this tool looked like this. Now, the interesting feature of this tool is that it has two ends, one of which can be used to dislodge the apple. There we go. And the other one, which can't, right? And so the experiment is, what do the chimpanzees do when they're presented with this novel tool? And the answer is they basically act randomly, right? They don't pick up the tool, orient it towards the small end, and stick it through. They'll try to pick it up. They'll try to stick the wide end through. They'll try to do this. They'll try to engage in all sorts of manipulations. And eventually, through trial and error, they can learn to solve this problem too. But they can't just sort of by inspection see that the way to dislodge the apple is to get the small end through the hole. So that was one of the experiments. In another experiment, also involving an apple, of course there's food rewards involved in all of these. The chimpanzees learned how to retrieve an apple that was out of reach using a tool that's sort of like a rake, right? It's a stick and it's got a rigid cross piece, and this could be used, the rake could be used to reach out and then pull the apple towards the animal who could then retrieve the apple. So chimpanzees were presented with an apple that was out of reach, and again, through trial and error learning, they figured out how to use the tool to retrieve the apple. Then in the second stage of this experiment, the chimpanzees were given a novel tool, and it looked like this. So it's like the original tool. It's a stick, but the end is completely floppy, right, instead of being rigid. And they were given this tool and basically allowed to engage in free play with this tool. And then in the final stage of the experiment, they were presented a situation where there was an apple that was out of reach. The experimenter would hold up the two tools, would do this with it, you know, on one end to show that it was, that this one was rigid, would bend this one to show that it was floppy, would put them down on the ground, and the question is which one would the chimpanzee use to try to retrieve the apple? And once again, they basically just guess randomly, right? They would just sort of randomly choose one of the objects and try to reach with it. They didn't discriminate between the tool that was appropriate for the task and the tool that was inappropriate for the task. I'll give you one more example. Of course, this experiment is different in one very important respect, namely the object to be retrieved was a banana. And chimps would be given a choice between, now let's see if this will work. I'm not sure if this is going to work successfully or not. In one situation, the rope is lying on top of the banana. And in the other setup, will this work? It's going to come. No. Okay. So the opacity doesn't quite work here. So they'd first learn how to retrieve a banana when it was sitting on top of a rope. But then, when faced with the situation where there was a banana sitting on top of a rope, and one where there was a banana with a rope draped over it, they again didn't know which one to pull in order to get the banana. Okay. Well, these are just three of the 27 experiments that were done by Pavanelli and his team. And there's a common pattern in the results of all these experiments, that the chimps were very good at trial and error learning. So if you posed a problem for them, they would engage in kind of random behaviors. They would hit upon one that worked. They would learn that it would work. And then in future trials, they would repeat that behavior. But then when they were presented with a variant of the original problem, they would just sort of follow through the procedure they had learned without discriminating really the functionally relevant properties of the tools that they were using. They would just kind of indiscriminately try to apply the procedure that they had learned the previous time. A separate set of results that's interesting has to do with the much vaunted imitation skills of apes. It turns out that apes don't ape. So there was an experiment done by Tomasello and Call on orangutans, in which they were presented with a box with a stick attached to it. And in order to open the box, you had to manipulate the stick a certain way, you know, maybe turn it to the right and then move it, or move it up and across, and so on. And they had a very interesting experimental design. What they did is they gave this puzzle to some of the orangutans, and they learned through trial and error how to solve it. And then they would let a second orangutan watch one that already knew how to solve the problem, and then they would present the box to the one, to the observer. And the orangutans kind of understood, play with the box and you'll get a reward, but they weren't able to imitate the motions that they had observed. They weren't able to, you know, reproduce the motions. The best they could do was realize, you know, engage in some kind of trial and error learning with this box and see if you can figure out how to open it. These results are in stark contrast to what happens if you perform similar experiments with human beings, even as young as 3 and 4 years old. So even very young children can succeed in these kinds of tasks. Colin Tomasello actually repeated their experiment with 4-year-old children and found that 4-year-old children could solve the task that orangutans couldn't. There have been not exact reproductions of Pavanelli's experiments so far as I'm aware, but there were experiments that were done by Anne Brown where children had to reach for a toy and learned how to reach for a toy and then were given a choice of tools that resembled the original tool in various respects, color, shape, size, rigidity, and children were very adept at choosing the appropriate tool for reaching the toy. They knew that, you know, don't just choose a tool that's the same color as the one you originally used, you know, that sort of shape, size, rigidity, these things matter, and so on. So there's a really stark contrast here between the performance of us and the performance of our nearest relatives. Now, what are we to make of this difference? What are we to make of it? Pavanelli, his interpretation of it is that he thinks that the chimpanzees are positivists, namely that they don't posit unobservable causes to explain why they're manipulations succeed, why their interventions succeed in the world. And by unobservable causes, Pavanelli has in mind things like rigidity and weight. So in the case of the rake experiment, the rigidity is what's relevant to being able to pull the apple. In the case of the rope with the banana on it, understanding the concept of weight and how that works. Now, I find this interpretation really puzzling. First of all, as far as I can see, these concepts aren't unobservable, right? I mean, weight is something that can be observed, can be detected. Rigidity is something that can, you know, both of these things can be observed through the sensory modality of touch. The apes are presumably able to make perceptual discriminations of these things. I bet that you could train a chimp, you know, if you rewarded it for choosing the heavier object, it would be able to succeed in this kind of task. So it's not as if chimps, you know, really lack the relevant concepts, the relevant categories. So I find his attempt to explain this a little bit different. And in particular, in the first experiment, it's not even clear how, maybe rigidity plays a role in terms of, but it seems like a straightforward problem of geometry, right? It's you can't put a larger object through a smaller hole, and it's sort of hard to imagine how the explanation of that in terms of unobservable causes goes. I mean, it seems that everything involved in that is fully observable. Well, I'm not going to try to explain these results, but what I'm going to try to suggest, I'm going to suggest a framework for thinking about these differences that I think is a fruitful way of thinking about them. So I'm going to start with some very familiar ground, just by reviewing some of the standard approaches to causation that have been offered. And for reasons that will become apparent when I talk about each one of these things, I want to focus on what each of these theories would suggest about the epistemology of causation. So according to each of these approaches, what would we expect to be the procedures for inferring that causal relations are present? And secondly, what would these theories suggest about the uses of causal information? In what context would we use causal information on these various theories? So, the oldest of the standard approaches is the regularity approach associated with Hume and Mill. And of course, John Mackey has a more recent version in terms of Inness conditions that most of you are familiar with. I'll lump into this category as well probabilistic theories of causation, Supes, Cartwright, and that paper that Hugh mentioned earlier, Elriel's. So the key idea behind in regularity theories of causation is that causes are regularly followed by their effects. So causation is to be understood in terms of regular association. The idea behind probabilistic theories of causation is that the effect occurs more often, or the effect is more probable in the presence of the cause than in the absence of the cause. So on this kind of picture of what causation is, what would the epistemology of causation look like? Well, this would suggest that we would learn about causal relations by observing patterns of association, by observing regularities in the world. And this can kind of take many forms. From one form familiar in psychology, classical conditioning. So this is the story of Pavlov's dogs, right? That they learned an association between the ringing of a bell and the appearance of food. And this kind of classical conditioning, this kind of ability to learn associations, is common in all, well, I don't know if all animal species, but in very primitive animal species. But of course, we can, you know, there are much more sophisticated versions of this. So, for instance, we can keep very careful data and perform statistical analyses on them to sort of detect the patterns. We can measure the correlation coefficients and so on. But this is kind of a sophisticated version of the same idea. That is, we're observing the regularities that occur in nature and inferring causal relationships on that basis. What do the regularities theories suggest about the characteristic uses of causal information? In what contexts would we use causal information? What would causal information allow us to do? Well, what these naturally suggest is that the use of causal information is for prediction, right? If we know that A's are regularly followed by B's, then when we see an A, we can predict that a B will occur, right? So regularity theories of causation suggest that causal knowledge comes into its own, especially in the context of prediction. Another approach to causation, the process mechanical account or model of causation. So process theories focus on causal processes or processes that transmit causal influence across space and time. These are things like cricket balls, cars, photons, sound waves, and so on. And causal processes need to be distinguished from pseudo-processes like spots of light and shadows that aren't able to transmit causal influence. The leading current approach to this is the one defended by Phil Dow, which says that the difference between causal processes and pseudo-processes is that the causal processes are able to transmit conserved quantities. Now, I'm going to lump into this category. I'm kind of painting some with very broad brushstrokes here. Kind of mechanical conceptions of causation, accounts that refer to mechanisms. So I have in mind here the work of Macomber, Darden, and Craver on mechanisms and Stuart Glennon on mechanisms. These emphasize the kind of complex systems within which cause and effect are connected. So both of these approaches, the sort of the process approach, the mechanical approach, lay emphasis on sort of how causes and effects are physically connected up with each other. Now, what does this approach suggest about the epistemology of causation. Well, again, there's some interesting experimental work done by the psychologist Michaud, who presented subjects with, and I'll give you a very sophisticated high-tech animation here. Presented subjects with animation that would look something like this, right? So one object appears to collide with the other. And when subjects viewed this, they claimed that they could see one object causing the other to move. Subjects actually reported seeing the causation there. And Michaud varied the conditions or varied what they observed. And if you manipulate it in certain ways, so for instance, if subjects observe something like this, or subjects wouldn't claim to see the causation, right? So it was only in kind of the physically natural collisions that subjects would report that they could see the causation. So this suggests that there's a sort of part of our perceptual apparatus is set up to detect causal interactions involving exchange of momentum and to kind of and that the kind of physically natural ones leap out at us in a special way. But we also are going to learn about causal processes and mechanisms through the application of naive and sophisticated physical theories, right? So it's, you know, the sophisticated level, we're going to learn about conserved quantities like baryon number and, you know, find out what kinds of things count as causal processes in this theory. And causal knowledge, characteristic uses, understanding the workings of complex systems. And so my example of the toilet tank sort of illustrates this, that the kind of mechanical knowledge we have tells us how that system works, how it functions. Manipulability approaches to causation, which we've heard a fair bit about this morning, especially from Brad's talk. This approach claims that causal relations are those that can be exploited for purposes of manipulation. Right? So if A is a cause of B, then I can use A as a handle to influence whether B occurs. Or as it's sometimes put, I can wiggle B by wiggling A when A is a cause of B. Or A is a reliable means for producing B. This way of thinking about causation most naturally suggests an epistemology of causation, that we learn about causal relations through our interventions in the world, that we learn about causation by going into the world and manipulating things. And again, this kind of reasoning can occur at many levels. First operant conditioning, right? That creatures learn about the effects of their actions through trial and error learning. Again, many very, most animal species are able to engage in this kind of learning. They learn about the effects of their actions, learn which of their actions produce rewards, and so on. But at a more sophisticated level, we can do controlled experiments, and this is a very sophisticated form of trial and error learning, where we actually sort of manipulate things. And this approach to causation suggests that the characteristic use of causal knowledge is as a guide in intervening in the world. If we have causal knowledge, we know what the effects of our actions will be. We know how to effectively intervene in the course of nature in order to bring about the outcomes that we desire. Finally, the counterfactual theory of causation, due, of course, primarily to David Lewis. This, according to this approach, causes are conditions sine qua non for their effects. C is a cause of E if it's the case that if C hadn't occurred, E wouldn't have occurred. This suggests that we learn about cause and effect reasoning by a kind of mental simulation, right? We can't actually do the experiment of undoing something that's already occurred, but we can kind of imagine what would have happened if the cause had been absent. So we can engage in a kind of simulation. And this kind of simulation can be aided through the use of computer models and through mathematical models. One of my favorite problems from my freshman physics course from the textbook went like this. It said, imagine that the Earth weren't rotating and that it were of uniform density, and that you drilled a hole all the way through it, and you dropped an object into the, you dropped a rock into the hole, what would happen? Okay? Well, it turns out that it behaves like a harmonic oscillator. Right? Goes up and down. And you know, this is something that you wouldn't be able to figure out just by kind of using your imagination. I mean, this is a really kind of a really far-fetched counterfactual, but with the aid of a mathematical theory, we can compute what the result of that hypothetical situation is. And the character, what counterfactual theories would suggest about the characteristic use of causal information is that we can use it for retrospectively evaluating responsibility. So if we want to know what is responsible for some effect or some outcome, we look back and see how that outcome could have been avoided. Right? What differences would have made a difference for whether or not that outcome occurred. More future-directed, it suggests that causal information is useful for engaging in hypothetical reason. What would happen if I were to do such and such? What would happen if such and such were to occur? So this is, well, this is what John Ehrman refers to as the Huns and Visigoth style of philosophy, where you just come rampaging through and cover a lot of ground really quickly. You kind of rampage and pillage and so on. So, but this is a very familiar ground, an overview of some of the main approaches to think about causation. I now want to change gears a little bit and talk about an approach to understanding theoretical terms or theoretical concepts from the logical empiricists. And I think that the neatest presentation of this is in Carl Hempel's paper, The Theoretician's Dilemma. So in this paper, Hempel asks, what are the role of theoretical concepts in a theory? Well, he said theoretical terms, but I'm playing a little loose, maybe from the linguistic context to kind of conceptual context. What role do theoretical concepts play? And what he said is, if, as the early positivists briefly thought, it would be possible to translate theoretical terms into purely observational terms without remainder, then there's a sense in which theoretical concepts would be redundant. In principle, they could be dispensable. Right? They were, at best, convenient shorthands. Right? So it might make inferences simpler, might involve fewer steps. But in principle, anytime we employ a theoretical concept, we could get rid of that theoretical concept and just plug in its observable paraphrase, and we could use that to derive various predictions and so forth. However, if theoretical concepts cannot be only partially interpreted via what Carnap called reduction sentences, then Hempel claimed that theoretical concepts play a role in what he called inductive systematization. And he illustrated this with a toy example. So suppose we've got a theoretical term, white phosphorus. And this term is partially interpreted in observable terms with the following reduction sentences. So white phosphorus smells like garlic. White phosphorus will dissolve if placed in turpentine. Right? Now, this isn't an analysis of white phosphorus. We haven't, you know, given a set of necessary and sufficient observable conditions for something's being white phosphorus. Right? And now suppose that our theory includes as a proposition that white phosphorus ignites at a temperature of 30 degrees Celsius. Now, what can we do with this theoretical concept? Well, we can make an inference that if we find some substance and it smells like garlic and it dissolves when we place it in turpentine, then we can make an inductive inference, a kind of hypothetico-deductive inference, that it will ignite at a temperature of 30 degrees Celsius. So we've got a kind of inductive inference that we couldn't make without this theoretical concept. So the idea, Hempel's idea, and it's kind of shared by other logical empiricists, is that theoretical concepts facilitate certain kinds of inductive inferences, right? And this is the role that they play. So what I'd like to suggest is that we could apply something like this idea to causation and think of the various rival attempts to analyze causation, or the various rival theories of causation, as being like Carnapian reduction sentences, right? Things that give partial interpretation of causation. So let me illustrate this with a kind of toy example akin to Hempel's. So suppose we've got two propositions, which I'll call reg and man. You can do the mnemonics yourself. So reg says that if C causes E in background circumstances B, then in those circumstances, E will occur more frequently when C is present than when it is absent. Okay. Man says if in circumstances B, intervening to produce C is a reliable means for producing E, then C causes E in those circumstances. Now, neither one of these is an analysis of causation, right? So reg only purports to give a necessary condition for causation. It doesn't provide a sufficient condition for causation. Right. So it's a, yes. So purports to give a necessary condition rather than a sufficient condition. And we know, for instance, that the converse of reg will fail in when we have effects of a common cause in cases of spurious correlations, right? Man purports to give a sufficient condition but not a necessary condition for causation. And we know, for instance, that the converse of man will fail if we've got causes that, for practical reasons, can't be manipulated, that we're not capable of intervening on, right? So neither one of these gives a satisfactory analysis of causation. Nonetheless, with these two propositions, we can make an inference from the following. We observe that in circumstances B, E occurs more frequently when C is present than when it is not. We can make an inference, defeasible, revisable, that in circumstances B, intervening to produce C is a reliable means for producing E. Right? So evidence in terms of observed observation of observed regularities provides evidence about what the effect of a certain intervention will be. And I think it's easy to see that being able to make these kinds of inferences would be very useful. Right, to make inferences from observed regularities to the effects of our interventions. So let me kind of generalize this idea. So we've talked about different theoretical approaches to causation. Let me introduce a little bit of terminology. Let's talk about these as different causal modalities. So regularities, intervention relations, counterfactuals, processes, mechanisms. These are different causal modalities. And what I'd like to suggest is that a central role of the concept of causation is to facilitate intermodal inferences that run across these different modalities. And what I want to suggest now is that this way of thinking about the concept of cause provides a useful framework for thinking about the differences, the different capacities of human beings and primates and other animals when they engage in causal reasoning tasks. So roughly the idea is, and this is putting it kind of very, probably overstating the case, but that human beings make intermodal inferences, other species don't. And what enables us to make these intermodal inferences is that we possess a full-blooded concept of cause that other species don't possess. So let's look at this claim a little bit more carefully and sort of return to some of these experiments that have been done with primates from this perspective. So first thing to note is the claim that primates and other animals aren't able to engage in intermodal inferences would be a whole lot less interesting if they also are very bad at making intramodal inferences, right? It would be sort of failing to locate the difficulty. So let's look at the individual modalities. In the case of regularities, as I noted, all animals are very good at detecting regularities and being able to make predictions and forming expectations on the basis of observed regularities. So they're able to observe regularities and use their experience of the regularities they've observed to make predictions about what will happen. Again, remember Pavlov's dogs. If drooling is kind of a prediction that food will arrive, right? So they're able to make those kinds of intramodal inferences. In the case of manipulability theories of causation, again, there's an enormous amount of evidence that animals are able to learn about the effects of their own actions, right? You can train animals to perform certain actions by rewarding them for behaving a certain way. Animals learn which of their behaviors will be rewarded, which of their behaviors will be punished. So animals can learn through experience what the effects of their actions will be as a result of their interventions, experience about what happens when they intervene on the world. What about mechanical knowledge, or what about folk physics? Now, this is a much trickier case, right? What do primates and other animals have a kind of folk physics? Do they have knowledge of processes and mechanisms? Well, they certainly, animals can track moving objects. They can reach and grasp things and that might suggest a kind of rudimentary, at least, mechanical knowledge. What would be desirable would be to have something akin to the Michaud experiments done in animals. To my knowledge, that hasn't been done. But there have been some interesting experiments done by Mark Hauser and Laurie Santos involving a looking time paradigm. So what a looking time paradigm is that you perform an experiment and you measure how long the animal looks at the result. And the idea is that outcomes that violate their expectations will cause them to look longer at it, right? So if you give them an experimental setup and the outcome is consistent with their expectations, they won't look at it for very long. But if the outcome is inconsistent with violates their expectations, they'll spend longer looking at it. So here's an example of an experiment they did with rhesus macaques. So what we have here is a shelf with a back on it. So we've got an upper shelf here and a lower shelf. And so that the monkeys are shown the shelf, and then this is occluded by a screen. Well, you can kind of see through it there, but you get the idea. And then the experimenter drops an apple above the apparatus, right? So the drop the apple, and then the apple sort of disappears behind the screen. And then the screen is removed, and in some of the conditions, the apple appears on the top shelf, and in other experimental conditions, the apple appears on the bottom shelf, and this is done with sleight of hand. There's a little trap door in the back of the apparatus they introduce the apples through, right? And they measured the amount of time that the macaques would stare at this apparatus after having observed this. And sure enough, there was a real difference in looking time, so that when the apple appeared on the top shelf, they wouldn't look at it as long as they did when the apple appeared on the bottom shelf. So this seemed to indicate that the rhesus macaques had an expectation about where the apple would go when it was dropped, suggesting some kind of, you know, understanding that one solid object cannot pass through another solid object, a kind of rudimentary bit of naive physics. What's interesting about this, from my perspective, is that when they did a slight variation on this experiment, what they did is they would drop it behind a screen, the apple behind the screen, and then instead of the macaques seeing where the apple was, there'd be two boxes there, and they would then allow the macaques to approach and search for the apple. The macaques would search in the bottom box, right? So if you just tried to determine kind of what their expectations of the result of dropping the apple were, the result was they expected it to land on the top shelf. When they actually were engaged in intervening in the world, searching for food, right, they wouldn't, they somehow couldn't make use of that knowledge. They couldn't make use of that piece of physical knowledge. So my suggestion is that we can think about the sort of cognitive failings of primates as an inability on their part to make intermodal inferences. That is, even though they have a kind of rudimentary physical knowledge, or kind of rudimentary folk physics, they're not able to make inferences from the kind of physics of a system to what the effects of their interactions on that system will be. So that in apes, kind of mechanical knowledge and means-end reasoning are modular in a way that they aren't in human beings. They're sort of impermeable to other kinds of evidence. So what about inferences? So this the Pavanelli experiments and the Tomasello and Call and the Santos and Hauser experiments suggest a kind of dissociation between mechanical knowledge and interventions. What about between regularities in interventions? What can be said about that? Well, in Alison Gopnik, as a developmental psychologist, I think put the question beautifully when she asked this question. Why don't Pavlov's dogs try to ring the bell? Sorry for the stray apostrophe there, right? So Pavlov's dogs, they observe a bell followed by the delivery of food, bell followed by the delivery of food. Why don't they try to ring the bell themselves, right, to bring about food? There's a very interesting recent experiment done on rats by Blaisdell, Waldman, and somebody else whose name I forget. They did a couple different experiments, but I'll describe one of the experiments to you. The rats were shown, maybe I'll screen off in the literal, not Reichenbachian sense, part of this. The rats were shown one of two patterns of association, right? Some of them were shown a flash followed by the delivery of food, and separately shown flash followed by a tone. And there's evidence in the conditioning literature that animals are kind of able to put the pieces together, right? So if you expose a rat to many cases of flash followed by food and many cases of flash followed by tone, and then you present the rat with the tone, the rat will then go look for food, right? So that they kind of understand the transitivity of correlation. The other rats were presented kind of with this pattern, so tone followed by a flash, and flash followed by presence of food. Then the rats were trained to press a lever and learned that by pressing a lever, they could produce a tone. Right? And here's something interesting. The rats that had been trained on this structure, when they pressed the lever and got the tone, well, I'll put it in an all or nothing framework. It's actually a matter of degree. These rats, when they heard the tone, wouldn't go look for food, right? These rats, when they pressed the lever and heard the tone, would go look for food. Actually, what happened is what they actually measured is the frequency with the rats poked their nose into the little food tray, and rats in both groups would poke it in, but the frequency was different. You know, it was sort of statistical difference in the frequency. So it's the rats that had learned this pattern of association kind of didn't expect there to be food when they heard the tone. It's as if they understood that interventions are arrow-breaking in a certain way, right? This is the arrow-breaking conception of interventions. But here's the really interesting thing. These rats didn't press the lever any more often than these ones did. Right, so it's as if they could understand the consequences for the association between tone and food, but they didn't understand the consequences of their own action. They didn't understand that they could thereby get food by pressing the lever. I don't know of any experiments that have tried to do this in apes, but I've got a nice juicy quote from Tomasello and Call. Suppose that an individual ape who has never before observed such an event for the first time observes the wind blowing a tree such that the fruit falls to the ground. If it understands the causal relations involved, that the movement of the limb is what caused the fruit to fall, it should be able to devise other ways to make the limb move and so make the fruit fall. We believe that most primatologists would be astounded to see the ape, just on the basis of having observed the wind make the fruit fall, proceed to shake a limb or pull the attached vine or create the same movement of the limb. The problem is that the wind is completely independent of the observing individual, and so causal analysis would have to proceed without reference to the organism's own behavior and the feedback it might receive from that. Right? Now, this isn't talking about observing a regularity, it's talking about observing a kind of one-shot instance. But I think the idea is there that suggesting that an ape wouldn't be able to make an inference from what it passively observes to what the effect of its action would be. So it suggests an inability to make that kind of intermodal inference. Now, obviously, there are more experiments that can be done, and I don't have the funding to do them or the training to do them. But I think this way of thinking about what's going on, that is, thinking about what's going on in terms of intermodal inferences, is a fruitful way of thinking about what's going on. It's kind of a helpful interpretive framework, and it suggests some interesting experiments that one might try to do to sort of further probe the ability of apes and other animals to engage in intermodal inferences. And even if it doesn't turn out, even if the truth is more subtle than the kind of stark way I'm presenting it, humans make intermodal inferences, other animals don't. It's still a kind of interesting way of thinking about the scenario, interesting way of thinking about the different cognitive capacities of different animals. I want to finish up by drawing some philosophical morals from this. So the first has to do with the role of the concept of causation. So I've suggested that it might be interesting to think about the concept of causation from using the kind of framework that Hempel was talking about in the theoretician's dilemma, that the role of a concept is to facilitate certain kind of inferences, and in particular, in the case of causation, its role is to facilitate intermodal inferences between things like regularities and intervention relations and processes and mechanisms. But it would be if you're taking this approach to kind of trying to understand the concept of causation, we might ask in a broader sense, what role does the concept of cause play in our lives? What can we do in virtue of having this concept? And the answer to that is interesting. And if I'm reading the empirical results right, the answer to that is kind of interesting and subtle. It's not the case that an organism needs a concept of cause just to survive, right? That finding food, finding a mate, reproducing, and so on, can be done without a full-blooded concept of cause. It can be done with separate modules, right, corresponding to the different modalities. So what is it that the concept of a cause allows us to do? Well, this is a question, obviously, for much more serious investigation than I can give it. But for instance, sophisticated tool use seems to be something that we can do, that we can make use of. It's not just a matter of opposable thumb, right? There's more to it. There's a lot more to it than that. A really speculative suggestion I want to put forward is that I suspect that the concept of cause is also very important to our social networks. That is, human beings are a very social species, and they engage in the most complicated social relationships of any species, and that the practice of assigning blame and responsibility and assigning credit for various outcomes plays an important role in our social interactions, and that a concept of cause might be very important for that. So that's a kind of suggestion. But in general, there's a kind of empirical work to be done in further articulating the role that the concept of cause plays for us. A second moral is one that I'll label Humean modesty. I think it's helpful in thinking about Hume to think of him as much as a psychologist as a philosopher. He took himself to be, or aspired to be, the Newton of the mind, right? His treatise of human nature really was, he thought of it as an empirical investigation into the way that human minds work. His methodology, the empirical methodology, was introspection, which is perhaps today not considered the most reliable methodology for doing psychology. But he took himself to be doing kind of empirical psychology. And a way of understanding, I think the right way of understanding his project is by doing psychology to articulate what the human mind is and is not capable of doing, right? And the reason those tomes of metaphysics and theology should be committed to the flames is that they deal in subjects that the human mind just isn't fit to deal with, right? There's certain things that we human beings are very good at, relations of ideas, mathematics, logic, matters of fact, empirical science. But there are subjects that fall between the cracks, metaphysics, theology. And those are just, we just have to be modest about the powers of our own reason, right? Hume uses the phrase the arrogance of reason, right? We should be modest about the powers of our own reason. And I suggest that, you know, reflecting on these experiments on primates and their difficulties engaging in causal reasoning might lead us to be a little bit modest and cautious about our own abilities. As a thought experiment, imagine that a chimpanzee were to do philosophy, and suppose that she were to try to offer an analysis of causation. I conjecture that she would fail spectacularly in doing this due to a kind of, you know, a genuine cognitive deficit. Right? Now, given that if my way of thinking about this is right, the concept of cause is very young in evolutionary time. Right? We might want to suspect that we ourselves have certain kinds of cognitive limitations with this concept. And we ourselves might run up against the limits of our cognitive abilities in trying to engage in this kind of philosophical project. And a final moral is one that I call self-aggrandizement, self-aggrandizing conclusion. There are times when I'm thinking up arcane counterexamples, cases of late trumping by double prevention that provide a counterexample to clause 3'' of so-and-so's theory of causation, that I find myself feeling a little bit as if I'm in something of an intellectual backwater. Philosophy, at least in most universities, is considered part of the humanities and the school of the humanities. And when you read descriptions of what the humanities, what the subject matter of the humanities is supposed to be, it'll say something like, the humanities study human beings, their culture, their modes of expression, the experience of being human. And if my way of thinking about this is right, well, darn it. When I'm thinking about causation, I am thinking about something that is peculiarly human, that is special about us. And I think I'll end there. That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. It's a good question.
Well, I don't think about it.
No, it's not unfair. It's a good question, and I mean, I suspect part of the answer to that is going to be that, you know, the ability to make intermodal inferences is more of a matter of degree than a kind of sharp all or nothing picture that I'm kind of suggesting for purposes of self-aggrandizement, but also just to kind of make the point more clearly. So there may be some kinds of intermodal inferences, but yeah, why bother to have the correct expectation for the location of the apple if you can't use it to then find the apple and eat it? I think that's an interesting question and a good question. And maybe the answer is just kind of, well, evolution doesn't always come up with the optimal solution to problems. It provides evolution basically jury-rigs things, and what you get is something is a sort of collection of heuristics that work well enough most of the time, right? So normally, when objects fall, there isn't some kind of solid surface blocking them, and so the strategy of looking at the lowest point for the fallen object works well enough most of the time that evolution doesn't build better intermodal reasoners. I don't know the answer to that.
So this is following just on this point. I mean, there's something in terms of the suggestion of there being this sort of modal specialization, so they can just see it, but they can't sort of convert it to action. For a long time, a lot of these same researchers that you were talking about thought that chimpanzees clearly don't have anything like a theory of mind. But recently, there's been a lot of work that says, okay, well, actually, if you put chimpanzees in competitive context, they are able to do things like solve a false belief task and things like that. So maybe something similar is happening here, where you have, if they were to do similar, I don't know how you design these sorts of things, but if it's a highly competitive situation, they can actually, maybe macaques can't do this, but chimpanzees might be able to have a better sense in which they can sort of move from some sort of visual presentation to action.
Right, and I guess, I think all I require is that be an interesting question to ask. Nothing that I'm saying really hinges on, well, except for the self-aggrandizement, hinges on, this being unique to humans. I mean, what I want to suggest is just that it's kind of, this is a helpful way of thinking about what's going on and sort of naturally suggests certain kinds of avenues of experimental research and so on. So yeah, I mean, it may turn out that way, or it may turn out that as you say, maybe the difference comes between chimps and macaques rather than between chimps and humans, right? Well, it would be interesting to find out.
Okay, I think the person in the dark up there, I think it's Craig, but I'm
yes.
Not quite sure.
I had two questions. They're both related. They were really about sort of what exactly the modalities were and the different things you were associating with each modality. So if you had that table and you had on the leftmost column, sort of the metaphysics of the different metaphysical positions, and then you had the epistemology and the typical views.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I just didn't see why any connection between the different things. I mean, so you have the regularity analysis. So that's what causation is. And then you have passive observation of patterns and stuff like this. And I just don't see how that follows from what it is. So I would say it's more of a kind of a typical prejudice. Associated with it or something. So none of these things are logically connected to each other, I don't think.
You mean none of these things across this way?
Yeah. So if I had a regularity analysis, I might think about intervening in the world. I might think I'm going to explain the workings of complex systems, etc.
Well, I mean, so let's stick to this with the regularity theory. A regularity theory, if causal relations are regularities, then in order to learn about causal relations, we have to learn about regularities, right? Sure, we could think about one type of regularities is when I do A, B follows, right? But the regularity account wouldn't privilege those as a sort of special class of regularities. The regularity theory by itself is kind of agnostic about what kind of physical connections there might be between causes and effects. I mean, the regularity theory is consistent with, you know, sort of with action at a distance or something like that, right? So I think the theories do kind of naturally suggest a certain epistemology.
I don't know. Anyway, I was thinking you don't really even need the metaphysics part really for the talk, because you could just think about, you know, there are these different epistemologies or different characteristic uses and do that. But even then, I was then worried about some of the experiments, why they were linking up with certain modalities and not others. I mean, sort of to take an example, the Michaud experiments. Mm-hmm. So you took that to be an example of the process mechanical. I didn't really see why that. Why couldn't it be frequencies, you know, regularities? I mean, so I see, you know, one thing, in close proximity with another, and if in a certain amount of time, then I think it's causal. Then I think one caused the other one. If I let there be the delay, then I don't think there's causation. You know.
Well, I mean, people report this in one-shot Michaud experiments. Right, I mean, and Hume famously, you know, thought that you don't have the idea of necessary connection until you've been exposed to repetitions of it.
But you've seen
Yeah. But whereas Michaud, you see the as you know the one thing causing the other, right? Now can you interpret the Michaud results in some kind of frequency framework? Yeah, conceivably. There's actually a nice paper by Patricia Cheng where she kind of argues that, you know, is criticizing the kind of Michaudian paradigm and suggesting that you could interpret this in terms of frequencies. That's fair enough.
Let's move on. Jeanette. Okay, Hugh.
Chris, thanks for a very nice talk. One idea that struck me is a sort of connection between your proposal about the sort of intermodal role of causation and a familiar kind of suggestion that you get in broadly kind of sort of Humean or Kantian anti-metaphysical accounts of causation. And the familiar suggestion is that causation in sort of metaphysical sense is a kind of it's a sort of reification of agency that we read into the world and the powers and causes of kind of over-anthropomorphizing the physical world. But it's extremely the nice thing about your story is it gives us a kind of possible suggestion as to why that's a good thing to do. Namely precisely that it solves the problem of getting over that intermodal gap between the bare frequencies that the wind causing the fruit to fall and the things we and our fellow agents do ourselves. We get over it by thinking of the world as constitutive agents as well.
Yeah, although presumably, I mean, I guess in some sense, this account is consistent. You know, you could be a realist or an anti-realist about it, right? Just as you can about other theoretical concepts, right? The world has to cooperate in order for this to work, right? So there's kind of, you know, no, there's no guarantee that the regularities that occur when we're not intervening in the world, or at least some of them, going to be the same regularities that happen when we intervene. I mean, the world has to cooperate in various ways. And, you know, one reason that might be so is that, you know, there really are causal relations out there and that these are kind of different ways of gaining access to what the causal relations are. But one could also be an instrumentalist about this and say, you know, it turns out to be a fact about the way the world works that these things are, you know, tend to be correlated. And when you have one, you have another. And having a concept that facilitates the inferences back and forth between them is therefore a very useful thing to have. So I think you could kind of, you know, you could be either an instrumentalist or a realist about it. Kind of part of what I was suggesting in the idea about Humean modesty is that you know, one shouldn't just take the line, and also in the kind of expanded role idea is that the idea, well, there are causal relations out there in the world, and evolution has crafted us to track them. Right, that line is going to be kind of hard to take, given the kind of facts of comparative psychology. That is, you know, lots of species survive without, you know, fully tracking these causal relations. And it would be pretty amazing if, boom, you know, here we are, and we've got it perfectly. Right, so it may well be that our concept of cause is kind of rough and ready, and it works very well, but doesn't, you know, track some one thing that is there in the world. But it's obviously the world's got to cooperate in some, you know, in some sense for this to work.
You're right.
And it's certain, I mean, I think in some sense it's an open question. It's not clear to me that just because one has the resources to ask a question that one therefore has the resources to answer it. You know, is there a God, for instance, right? The, you know, the mere fact that we can kind of have the concepts to ask the question.
actually, can I just comment on this? Because the way people, the point of this objection is you can answer the, you can formulate the answer. You can formulate the answer, yes, there is a God, and you can formulate the answer, no, there isn't a God. Now, whether you can choose which one is the right one, that's an extra question, extra issue. Likewise, we can formulate and understand sort of which are the different views of causation, but maybe not sort of pick the right one.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough. I mean, another thing is that, that humans have cultural products that enable us to overcome our psychology, right? This is an interesting feature about us. So that, you know, there are, for instance, you know, elementary mistakes in probability reasoning that humans make. This is, you know, Kahneman, Tversky, and the Linda problem. That can be overcome by developing a formal theory, which we can then use and put our faith in that rather than just our kind of naive intuitive judgments, right? So that's also something, it's kind of that's special about us and, you know, enables us to, in some sense, overcome some of our psychological limitations. So yeah, so it's, you know, it's an open question in some sense what follows from our psychological limitations, but just, you know, we may well have some. Jason.
Yeah, your finger on this, Jason?
Yeah. I mean, it's only to support what you said, but I mean, if I'm, what I'd like to say is don't do think about arithmetic. I see them thinking about arithmetic. What I should say if I'm more careful is we don't know. I think it's obvious that the vast bulk of experiments in this area that we want to do haven't been done yet. That's very consistent with your conclusions. And to make this very clear, your finger, here's an experiment that Haldane did a long time ago. He got some bees. Everybody knows and knew even in the 30s that bees go out, find flowers, come back and dance where the flowers are. Haldane got some flowers, I think, or just sugar, and stuck it vertically above a beehive. So clever. The bee went out, found it, came back, went, fuck, I don't know how to say that, and did dance anyway, but none of the other bees knew what it was talking about. So, I mean, of course, you can question my interpretation of that. But you shouldn't. I think there's no more reason to think that animals don't ask questions that are beyond them than to think that we do. Either we don't know, or there's evidence like that that suggests that they do ask questions and they're kind of nuts.
Rob?
Yeah, I'm really interested in a way of kind of reading what's going on in the talk, and sort of like relationship between what I take to be the kind of philosophical idea about causation and this Hegelian kind of treatment and the empirical sorts of findings and how they fit together, because it seemed like in response to an earlier question, you went the natural path to suggest, yeah, there are these two sorts of claims and they're independent from one another. You know, if you found, you know, you could slide up and down where you find causation coming in. And I sort of wondered about that. So in the background, there's that kind of worry. So here's a question. When I just see, you know, one shape hitting another shape or a baseball hitting a ball, you know, simple sort of case, is that intermodal? I would have thought that's just a case where I'm using one modality, visual perception, and there's something about perceiving causation there. So if that were the case, then both... Isn't it the case that animals are going to have, you know, they're going to have some kind of causal understanding of that kind, and that in turn feeds into the philosophical claim, because it looks like, well, that might be true, this claim about intermodal inferences might be true for certain sophisticated uses we make of causation, but that's not the basic notion of causation that we've got. Likewise, another sort of case to think about with that one, you know, tool use in chimpanzees particularly is well known. They not only use them, they design them. Right, with leaves, they pull leaves off to shape sticks in certain ways.
Through trial and error learning, though. I mean, at least if these experiments are right, it's through trial and error learning, not from their sort of on first principles knowing what shape this thing has to be in order to fit into the whole.
Right, but don't they still again have a kind of understanding of the whole causal setup, like they need to get something out of a whole around, trial and error, perhaps. They still know how to manipulate tools, they know how to shape up tools, they have an understanding of how they need to act in the world to get about certain kinds of results, even if in other cases they're bamboozled.
Yeah, I mean, this would suggest, I mean, my way of thinking about it is, no, that this is really, it's kind of, there's a sort of trial and error learning module, and that's what's going on in the tool use, that they're kind of, that just by kind of doing things randomly, they hit upon something that works, right? And this is sort of, what people observe, that sort of each chimp has to, you know, reinvent the wheel for themselves. They don't learn it by watching other chimps, for instance. You know, actually, Pavanelli did a variant on the experiment where they have to put the stick through the hole to get the apple, where he gave them a stick that had removable cross pieces, right, and to see what they would do. And again, they kind of they would do things like they'd remove the cross piece from one end and then they'd try to stick the other end through and things like that. So you know, there wasn't evidence of kind of clear purposive designing and fashioning of tools to make them appropriate to the task at hand. What there was rather a lot of was a lot of trial and error, a lot of random production of, sort of random modifications of an object, random motions with the object, and then hit upon something that works, and then repeat.
Right, but that's not what happens when they've got a simple stick, right? They just kind of know how to do that. It seems like they've got some rudimentary causal understanding.
Yeah, it does seem that, for instance, primates seem to understand what we might call principles of action by contact. Right, so if the apple's over there, you know, they will attempt to make contact with the apple using a tool. They won't, you know, poke the tool that way to see if that makes the apple over there fall down. Right, there are experiments that Hauser's done with tamarins where you train them to, you've got a piece of fruit on a blanket, and they pull the blanket to get the piece of fruit. Then you present them with a new scenario. One with a blanket that's the same color as the original one, but the piece of fruit is to the side of it. The other with a blanket of a new color with a piece of fruit on it, and they can solve that kind of problem. So I mean, I suspect that there's, you know, kind of matters of degree, or that there's some aspects of mechanical knowledge that they can translate into actions, right? I mean, it's not going to be an all or nothing break. So, and it seems that some kind of rudimentary understanding of action by contact is something that animals are able, or at least primates are able, to translate into action.
Okay, let's move on. I've got three or four questions. I think Jonathan next.
So two comments. First is that it's not clear that causation is going to be the only concept that's going to give us intermodal reasoning. So you might think, for instance, that counterfactual reasoning could support intermodal reasoning from regularities to manipulations. You might think that there are sort of pre-causal counterfactual reasoning, or at least that these are distinguishable forms of reasoning. You might say, well, maybe what the apes, what the chimps or macaques or whatever lack is counterfactual reasoning. And maybe they didn't have causal reasoning, but they don't have the counterfactual. So it's not obvious that the intermodality has to be coming from the causal concept. It seems like there's a lot of different conceptual sources for intermodality. And secondly, it didn't seem, at least from the cases that you were describing, it wasn't clear to me whether we should think of the chimps as lacking the concept of causality or counterfactuality, or whatever is giving the intermodality, or whether we should think that they have the concept, but what they lack is the ability to easily shunt it about from module to module. So you might think that, you know, if you think that they have like a sort of a statistical regularity associating module and a mechanic, you know, action outputting module or something like that. I think they have the concept of causation. They just can't easily move the concept from one box to the other. So maybe it's not the having the concept that's giving the intermodality It's having intermodularity that gives intermodality. It's being able to move a concept from module to module that allows us to do reasoning tasks that use the modules required for subserving one thought modality, allows it to apply it to the module for subserving the other thought modality.
Yeah, okay, so first question. Yeah, I mean, when I kind of, after introducing counterfactuals, I kind of stopped and didn't talk about them anymore. And I suspect that counterfactual reasoning is probably intermodal rather than being intramodal. So I doubt there's a kind of module for counterfactual reasoning. And, you know, one plausible way of thinking about what's going on is that the apes aren't able to engage in kind of the hypothetical reasoning of what would happen if I were to do this with the stick, but they have to actually do the experiment, right? So I suspect that's right, that sort of counterfactual reasoning is probably might be more tightly tied, might itself not be a module, but might itself involve a kind of intermodality that's going to be closely connected with causal reasoning. So the second question, I guess the question is, what makes it the same concept in each module if you can't move it back and forth, right? I mean, why? You know, how do you know you're not committing? Well, you know, if you can't make inferences, you know, C's are regularly followed by E's, therefore C's cause E's, therefore I can bring about an E by bringing about a C, right? If you're not able to make that move, how do we know that the cause in both those cases is the same thing? Right. If we don't make those inferences where we move the concept of cause from one module to another, and something it's not clear what it would mean to say that that's the same concept.
Oh yeah, Jeanette, thank you.
So this suggestion would be something like this. What's going on is that think of the Pavanelli. I suspect this is probably close to what Pavanelli himself thinks when he talks about chimps don't have unobservable concepts of unobservables like rigidity and weight and so on. And that way of putting it strikes me as very odd and unusual. But maybe what he means is they don't have concepts like weight and rigidity that connect up in a kind of web that would facilitate intermodal inferences from, you know, I see the thing, you know, I see the person doing this to, I can't use it to move the apple.
Exactly. And
right.
Represent those in terms of a small
I guess I mean it's partly maybe just a question of what you think you would have to have in order to have a concept of cause, and to me, it's sort of something that gives rise both to regularities that can be passively observed and that can be exploited for means of intervention in the world is kind of a pretty good start on what cause is,
right?
Okay. So that's the sense in which I think it's a concept of cause. Now, one line you might take is you might be Nancy Cartwright, right, and think that there's really not a unified notion of cause. What there is you know, there's pushing and burning and wetting and, you know, and breaking and so on and so forth, right? So there's a sort of whole class of causative verbs that have a kind of family resemblance to one another. And each of these, you know, so you might have a kind of a whole family of concepts that facilitate intermodal inferences.
No, hang on, because I've got at least three more questions, two from people who have not spoken. Should we have more questions, Hugh, or should we just finish now?
Just a couple of quick, very quick ones.
And Matthias, and then Greg, and then I think we'll finish.
Yeah, I mean, I like the basic idea, but I was wondering how good the evidence from the animal experiments is of what they really exhibit as a failure of these intermodal inferences, or if, you know, as a regularity theorist, you couldn't try to analyze all of them as failure to grasp certain relevant regularities. That apes are able to form certain regularities, but not the relevant ones. I mean, that it's a stick that, or an object whose diameter is smaller than the hole that you can poke through. But rather, they just think, take an object and try to poke it through. So I'm wondering if it's really failure, if it really suggests it's a failure of intermodal inferences, or could it just stick with any one of these accounts of causation and show that the failure of the apes is just to pick up the right sorts of...
What's interesting, I mean, and here's where you really would like to see a kind of contrast between the inter and the intramodal inferences. And so, for instance, I think the fact that you can... you know, you can present animals with two different regularities, one flash followed by food and flash followed by tone, and then when they hear a tone, they expect food, suggests that, you know, that they're making fairly sophisticated intramodal inferences, right? And that the, you know, there's a kind of qualitative difference in the abilities of the animals to make the intramodal inferences compared to the intermodal inferences, such that it would be sort of hard to explain the failures in these various experiments in terms of some kind of failure of intramodal inferences, just because there are lots of examples where they do make fairly sophisticated intramodal inferences. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I guess they might be fairly good at making certain intramodal inferences, though again, it's probably a matter of degree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Greg?
Just quickly, I was going to say that looking back at the philosophy of science with Carnap and Temple and so on, one further step away from positivism, going further than inductive systematization, is of course thinking of theoretical concepts as part of an explanatory theory which explains the phenomena. And then if we applied that to the causal case, we could raise the question of the seeing the concept of cause as a not so much an intermodal systematizing concept, but as an explanatory concept. Going in a couple of directions there. One would be to relate that to primates, where the idea of inference to the best explanation, or even some such thing, relate that to them. But going in another direction, if we look at those various things, regularity and manipulability and so on, if we take, by contrast with all of them, a causal powers account of causation, it seems that that's being put forward as a theoretical concept which explains the phenomena of regularity and immovability and so on. But of course it has very serious defects, and he said it's not a genuine scientific theory in the way that it's not that. And of course a scientific explanatory theory itself perhaps involves the concept of causation.
I think that the idea that you know, we posit causation to explain the regularities and intervening relations and so on is very tightly connected with. I mean, it's that would suggest that the intermodal inferences are abductive, at least abductive, and then bottom up and then top down, right? But that one of the steps is abductive. Right, and yeah, that seems plausible.
Okay, I think this is a good time to stop and thank Chris for his talk.